Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 22, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss Bitcoin and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back two repeat guests to Teleforum. We'll hear opening remarks at the outset from both of them, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. We have with us today Andrew M. Grossman. He's a partner at Baker & Hostetler and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He's joined by David B. Rifkin, Jr., also a partner at Baker & Hostetler, who's joining us from Austin, Texas today. With that, gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. Our subject today that David and I will be discussing is not only Bitcoin and not only its technological underpinnings, but really the next generation of cryptocurrency innovation. Now, we recognize, of course, that this is a complicated topic and it does involve a lot of technological issues. And so we're really going to start from the beginning, going over some of the more basic concepts about what Bitcoin is, how it works, and then getting into what the new innovations look like and some of the regulatory issues that they are raising today. So in terms of starting from the beginning, Bitcoin is best known, of course, as a cryptocurrency. It is a digital currency. Prior to Bitcoin, there was 20 years or thereabouts worth of history of digital currencies, people creating currencies that can be used to facilitate transactions online that can generally be exchanged one way or the other for legal tender, in other words, for government-issued currencies. The advantages of using digital currencies prior to Bitcoin were relatively elusive. Of course, everybody knows that it's easy enough to make credit card transactions online just using regular American dollars. And having to use a digital currency prior to Bitcoin required you to put another intermediary in the middle of every single transaction, because that intermediary would have to be the party that issued the currency, that kept track of who had it, and that reconciled all of the transactions at the end of the day. Typically, these types of digital currencies carried high transactions costs, were relatively inefficient, frequently were subject to bugs or fraud or manipulation, and in many instances were used to facilitate transactions on black markets or gray markets, or in some instances on markets that are underserved by other types of financial intermediaries, for example, pornography. Bitcoin is something very different. The innovation of Bitcoin over these prior types of digital currencies is that it is a distributed system. There is no one in control. The central feature of Bitcoin is something that's called a blockchain. Now, what that is a very fancy word for a simple ledger. Any bank, any person who is conducting any types of financial transactions, of course, has to keep and maintain a ledger of who owns what. If you've got a certain number of dollars that you're keeping track of, maybe that would be in your bank account. Your bank has got a ledger somewhere, probably on a mainframe, that keeps track of how much money is in everyone's account. Well, that is in fact what the blockchain does. The difference is that there's no bank. What the blockchain is a decentralized database that is operated by thousands of computers spread all over the world. And it uses a form of public key cryptography to verify transactions. So when somebody spends Bitcoins or transfers Bitcoins, they have to effectively enter a secret password that confirms that they are the owners of those particular Bitcoins. And so when they undertake a particular transaction, it is cryptographically verified before being added to this blockchain ledger to verify that yes, they own it. Yes, that it's clear that transaction did take place at a particular point in time. And yes, those Bitcoins have been transferred to some other party, and that party is represented by an address on the ledger, and presumably that party holds the secret keys so that they can subsequently access that value and then engage in subsequent transactions with it. this was Bitcoin's key innovation, the idea that you don't need some type of central intermediary to operate the currency system. And it really did facilitate an enormous amount of financial innovation. And that's really what's led to Bitcoin's enormous success, being by far the most popular digital currency that's ever been launched, and being used for billions of dollars worth of transactions and being accepted by tens of thousands, possibly more than that at this point, merchants. When you have something like this decentralized database, this blockchain, you don't need to trust any particular individual. Everything can be verified that a transaction has occurred because it's registered in the blockchain, and if it was not registered in the blockchain, then that's perfectly clear. Everything is timestamped in a particular way so that people can track what transactions have occurred and which ones haven't. Also, it facilitates relatively speaking, fast transactions. Interbank transactions and other types of electronic currency transactions that occur in traditional systems can take hours or sometimes even days to be reconciled. With Bitcoin, it can happen in a matter of minutes or in some instances, hours. It may not seem that fast in an age where you can click on something in Amazon and purchase it instantly, but in terms of those back-end financial transactions, it really was quite an innovation. Likewise, Bitcoin dramatically reduces transactions costs. Again, you've got this enormous decentralized database that's being operated by so-called miners, just computers spread over the internet. And what that means is that for a cost of sometimes a thousandth of a penny, sometimes a couple pennies, sometimes a little bit more, it depends on the transaction and other things like that, you can complete all manner of financial transactions. So in other words, it's also a lot cheaper to use, something that would be readily apparent to anyone who's used their bank to do wire transfers and paid a $10 or $25 fee to do that. That said, all is not well in the world of Bitcoin. One feature of this decentralized, nobody's in control aspect of it is, of course, that nobody's in control. And the Bitcoin network, particularly in recent months, has struggled to keep up with rising transaction volume in such a way that transactions are now taking longer to complete, transactions costs have begun to rise, and there really is a fear among a lot of people involved in the Bitcoin community that the current system as it is simply will not be able to scale to meet increasing demand and to allow the Bitcoin platform to fulfill its ultimate promise as providing widespread financial services and financial transaction abilities across a very large population of users. What might seem at first blush like a technological problem is actually, in fact, a political problem. I keep on mentioning this idea of miners. They're the people who operate the computers that run the Bitcoin network. They're called miners because what they do effectively is undertake very complicated cryptographic, they run special cryptographic software on their computers that verifies every single transaction and at the end of the day winds up adding blocks to the blockchain, to this distributed ledger, and each block contains a number of these verified Bitcoin transactions. The problem is that there are thousands of computers that are operating as miners on the network. They get paid a very small amount for doing this type of work. That's why they're called miners. Effectively, there are new Bitcoins that are added to the total number that are out there, and those are rewarded to the miner to add these blocks to the network. That's the incentive for them to run this network. And there's been a lot of controversy regarding ways that the central Bitcoin software might be modified so as to facilitate a larger scale of transactions. And at present, there appears to be a political impasse among different groups of miners, among different groups of developers, and among a lot of Bitcoin users as to what the right way forward is. And as a result of that impasse, a lot of people, I think, have predicted that Bitcoin may be effectively plateauing in terms of its capabilities and in terms of its popular uptake. But that really only brings us to the status quo, and it doesn't address what really is an enormous amount of creativity that's taken place and some very innovative ideas that have come to bear over the past year or so. If the central innovation of Bitcoin was the blockchain, the current innovation right now that is so exciting and is really very and is really promises a lot of the future innovation to come is the idea that not everything needs to be on the blockchain. In other words, the different parts of this Bitcoin ecosystem can be simply swapped out and replaced with other ones, with new ones, that operate alongside this existing system. Now, let me give you an example that's outside of the Bitcoin world that explains how this works, and then we'll transfer that over to how it actually functions with Bitcoin. If, for example, I think a simple example involves shares of stocks. Everybody, of course, is familiar with regular, typically available stock markets, and you might have the New York Stock Exchange or Amex or NASDAQ. And a regular investor can log on to their Fidelity brokerage account and can purchase, perhaps gradually over a period of time, a block of shares in some particular corporation that may be of interest to them. And it may be the case that over a period of time, that individual may acquire a large block of shares. In other words, not just a few here or there. Maybe this is a wealthy individual and they acquire thousands of shares. Well, in some instances, particularly with lightly traded stocks, you may not want to sell those on a regular market. There may not be enough liquidity. There may not be enough demand in regular consumer-facing markets for that. And so it's very typical in the financial world that, say, an institutional investor has a large block of shares, may put them up for sale on different types of electronic markets, for example, BATs. And in that way, you can effectively, even though you're trading stocks that are for sale and that are commonly traded over something like the New York Stock Exchange, you can engage in parallel market transactions on different markets, and BATs and other types of electronic trading platforms. So the idea is that at the end of the day, sure, there was a transaction in the stock, but it may not be a transaction that actually took place through the original and main stock market in which the stock is listed. Now, you can take that idea, swap of trading assets on different types of markets at the same time in parallel, and you can bring that over to Bitcoin. And what this concept is called is altchains, in other words, alternatives to the main blockchain. So with Bitcoin, you've got the core blockchain, the one that was developed with the Bitcoin software, and the one that currently is having difficulty scaling up to meet increased transaction volume. But what if you had a separate blockchain? What if you had a blockchain, for example, that was geared towards micropayments, a blockchain where perhaps certain types of verifications requirements were loosened somewhat, but high-speed transactions we've set up so that high-speed transactions could more easily occur. And it was set up so that transaction costs would be unusually low, so as to facilitate sending a couple cents here, a couple cents there, as one may pay for, say, a newspaper article on one website or perhaps a song from another website. The kinds of transactions that, if they weren't done with incredibly low transactions costs, would simply be infeasible to accomplish at all. And that's what people have recognized can be done with Bitcoin. That people who hold Bitcoin, people who can cryptographically verify that they have access to a certain amount of value that's recorded in the Bitcoin network, can take that value and can trade it on these altchains. And there's not simply one kind of altchain. As the example I gave indicates, different types of altchains can be tuned for different sorts of use cases. Bitcoin mining, as I noted, is undertaken by computers that go through these incredibly complicated algorithms to double-check every single transaction that is entered on the network and to verify which ones are true before allowing them to be added to the blockchain. On the one hand, that's a very secure and very sensible method of doing it. On the other hand, it results in an enormous waste of energy. You've got thousands of computers trying to calculate what is the next block to be added to the blockchain. And at the end of the day, only one of them, in general, will complete that next block and thereby be rewarded with some Bitcoin for having done that and for having added the block to the blockchain. A different way of approaching that might be to have some type of buffered mining, where people operating computers still do verify the transactions, but they do it in a more distributed way that might entitle them to be rewarded with a portion of the total reward for a block. There might be other ways of operating a blockchain-type network that simply don't rely on mining at all, and people have proposed several different ways of doing that. Now, the advantage is that if you're not forcing these computers to be doing all of this busy work for hours on end, you wind up saving a lot of energy. And so for people who are concerned about the environment, that may be a particular plus, and that may be something that they would like to be involved in. Other types of networks, as I noted, may facilitate microtransactions. They may facilitate high-speed transactions. Some of them are geared to large volume transactions. For example, it may make sense in some instances for large Bitcoin brokerages, people, you know, where Bitcoins may be used to pay for stocks or to engage in other types of financial transactions, that, you know, the relatively small number of the operators of those markets may wish to create their own side networks so that Bitcoin that are present on in one person's platform, in one of those companies' platforms, can be transferred between those. In other words, it's the equivalent of loading up a Brinks truck and bringing it between banks. This would be, you know, a very durable and very secure network, but at the same time, it would accomplish transactions in a way that would have benefits to those heavy users of Bitcoin. There are other ways, I think there are other facilities that can also be interesting that are a little bit off the beaten path, but some people have already begun to consider them. In one instance, you know, Bitcoin is known for being a little bit freewheeling and for allowing any manner of transaction, but in some instances, you may want to have more control and more auditing. For example, a parent may want to allow their child to have access to a certain amount of Bitcoin value to purchase things online, for example, at music or things to read and so on, but they may want to do that on a network that is limited to certain types of vendors where there's a very heavy control and auditing so the parents can keep track of exactly how it is that that money is being spent. That's something that can be facilitated on an alternative blockchain. In the complete opposite direction, Bitcoin, the main Bitcoin blockchain, because it uses this publicly accessible blockchain, in some instances, certain types of transactions can be traced, and it's possible if you do a lot of forensic work to figure out, in some instances, who exactly are the people engaging in certain types of transactions. Now, that can be a benefit in terms of financial auditing, but it can actually be quite scary in some of the more totalitarian countries where Bitcoin has gained a foothold because of its relative anonymity. One possibility for alternative blockchains is to facilitate certain types of privacy-enhancing features, as well as to provide resiliency against censorship. In other words, to make it difficult for people, particularly for governments, to block certain types of payments. A final thing that I'll note is the possibility of smart contracts. There are certain ways that contracts can be effectively digitized and made to be self-executing when certain types of financial prerequisites occur. In other words, based on some external event or based on some event that's internal to a Bitcoin network, the network itself may undertake the transfer of value from one account to another or do other kinds of complicated financial things, for example, escrow-type transactions. These are the kinds of things that could be implemented via algorithms, in other words, undertaken automatically by the network itself and by the computers that comprise the network. All chains provide the opportunity to create that type of financial innovation and to see how it works and see what people are interested in doing. The past few years of Bitcoin development have, you know, looking at it from the Washington, D.C. point of view, have been a period of the regulators playing catch-up and trying to figure out how do you take this really wild west and these very new concepts that nobody's in control, if there's not simply one party you can go regulate, how do you take all these things and how do you plug them into our existing regulatory superstructure, particularly involving things like money transfer laws? Everybody, of course, is concerned about money laundering. And that's, unfortunately, it tends to be a use of any type of financial transaction system, whether it's $100 bills being stuffed in suitcases, or whether it's Bitcoin value being zapped across the internet. And the question is, when you've got these startups and these innovator companies that are involved in creating Bitcoin-based services, and you've got this wildly decentralized network, how exactly do you apply our existing money laundering type laws and existing reporting laws and know your customer requirements and so on to these new technologies? In general, that problem has been addressed by the Treasury Department, and in particular, its Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, that is FinCEN, under the auspices of the Bank Secrecy Act. And I have to say, FinCEN in general has done a relatively good job of principally exercising regulatory forbearance in a lot of different areas, in recognizing that decentralized networks that where no one is in charge do present some unique challenges, and by focusing really on the on-ramps, in other words, where traditional currencies are being exchanged for digital currencies, and where digital currency is moving in terms of location or moving in terms of ownership. And so by focusing on these very specific use cases, They've been able to provide, I think, a great deal of regulatory certainty for companies and innovators that are looking to launch products in this area. And at the same time, still, you know, not bogging down a lot of innovators with very burdensome regulatory requirements that at the end of the day would hinder innovation and potentially wouldn't necessarily do a lot in terms of enforcing money laundering and other money transfer laws and policies. That said, what we're talking about today, this idea of alternatives to different points, parts of the Bitcoin network, that really is something new. It's something cutting edge, and it's something that FinCEN and other regulators haven't had a chance to address yet. It really does present a lot of very complicated issues, because with Bitcoin, you have this anonymous creator, Satoshi Nakamoto, pseudonym, who simply introduced the system to the world and himself never really made a business of it. Whereas now you've got companies that are looking at different types of alternatives to the main Bitcoin blockchain, and are trying to figure out, well, if we launch these things in the network, if we're trying to provide these alternatives for whatever reason that may provide benefits over the existing blockchain, what is the regulatory risk? Where does that put us? Because in some instances, the laws are relatively ambiguous, and the guidance that's been put out by FinCEN doesn't necessarily apply as neatly as it might to the questions that are raised by things like alt chains. I think a general principle to keep in mind here is, you know, that all of these that these regulations are really focused on very particular concerns about how these types of services may be abused. And so in every instance, there has to be consideration of, are you really advancing the policies of the law? Are you blocking things like money laundering? Or are you simply taking requirements and verbosely applying them to new technologies where they may not really make a lot of sense? So with respect to alternatives the main Bitcoin blockchain, there really is, I think, a strong case for regulatory forbearance for companies that are merely engaged in releasing this type of software and creating these kinds of networks. That's not to say, however, that that companies that are involved in money exchange, literally that are exchanging one kind of money for another or one kind of virtual currency for another type of virtual currency, should not be regulated and shouldn't have to comply with the panoply of requirements that apply under the Bank Secrecy Act. In that sense, FinCEN's approach of regulating those particular entry points has actually been very sensible, and that carries over to this new idiom. But at the same time, there are these types of ambiguities, particularly when you have alt chains that in some sense may be operating as new virtual currencies. Every time you create a new blockchain, technically speaking, you've got a new thing, it may not be regarded as a currency, but you've got some kind of new token, some kind of new store of data, some type of new unit of transaction that is present on that blockchain, even if at the end of the day, the transactions that are taking place on that blockchain may be denominated in terms of Bitcoin. This is a complicated area, and our view is that there certainly is a very strong case for regulatory forbearance, because a mere feature of a computer program, something that's not in and of itself ascribed any particular value, but is nothing more than a digital token. In other words, something that itself is not meant to be interchange, not meant to be a unit of interchange or a unit of value in and of itself, is the kind of thing that it really doesn't make sense to apply the laws to. That said, the law's application is a little bit ambiguous at this point in time. And as we describe in our paper published by the Federalist Society, there really is a case for further guidance here, as well as, in our view, some additional forbearance by the agencies. And that's the kind of regulatory certainty that would be very useful for innovators in this field, that would facilitate the development and expansion of a lot of products that are currently in development, and some that even that have been launched in recent months, and would really allow a lot of creativity and innovation and diversity to blossom in this area. I think we've covered a lot of ground here, and I'm sure there are going to be some questions. But before we do that, let me see if David Rifkin has anything he'd like to add to that analysis.
Thank you, Andrew. This is David Rifkin. This is a comprehensive tour de force, and we're quite down the road time-wise. But I would just make one policy argument to be coupled with Andrew's point about resiliency to censorship that these types of networks offer. That would benefit, of course, is greater resilience to hacking. which is inherent in any network that does not have sort of a central administrating capability. And we, of course, live in a world where hacking and cyber attacks are very much, unfortunately, the order of the day, both driven by private miscreants, but also increasingly driven by rogue states. So having a growing viable alternative to the traditional networks, centralized networks for dealing with financial transactions is certainly highly desirable. Now, it's not to say that these any network that is based upon computing has some vulnerabilities, but again, the distributed nature of both the Bitcoin and the alternative chains is a lot more resilient to particular types of hacking. That's a good thing. We can move on now.
Very good. Thank you very much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. A reminder to our callers while we're waiting to see who clicks in with a question to check your emails and check the website for information on our next upcoming Teleform conference calls. Also, the paper mentioned by Andrew Grossman is available on the website, and it's in the link to the information sent to each of you about this call. The title of the paper is The Alt-Chain Revolution, Regulatory Considerations for the Next Wave of Bitcoin Innovation. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask the first question, see if the audience gets involved here. You've talked about a lot about background and about next steps. I'm wondering if there are any businesses that have launched products that you, Andrew Grossman in particular, mentioned, you know, micro payments, other limited transactions that can be monitored, other types of things. Are there some business models out there that are being developed or have been launched?
There are, and I think right now there are two that to me are very interesting and that are maybe worthy of noting. One is called Liquid. It's what's called a sidechain. This is getting a little bit complicated, but what they mean by a sidechain is that it's an alternative blockchain, but it's one that is algorithmically linked to the main blockchain, so that these types of transactions, so that moving from one chain to another can be done in a highly automated and very resilient fashion. I think there's going to be a lot more of that coming down the road. And what Liquid does that's different from the regular blockchain is that it allows very high volume transactions in a high-speed fashion. And so it really provides a means for Bitcoin brokerages and financial services firms, and banks, and so on to do these very large balance transfers. So if a party has a balance at a particular bank, they can spend that directly at a brokerage or at somebody offering a financial services firm just merely by linking their accounts, and the transactions, the actual movement of funds, just takes care of itself in the background using this Liquid network. The other one that I've mentioned that's very interesting is the Bitcoin computer launched by a company called 21. Now, principally, the purpose of this computer is to allow individuals to develop and to offer for sale their own digital services and to purchase digital services that are offered on this network. They've created a 21 network that works in tandem with Bitcoin and with some other things. The neat thing that they thought that they have is that their hardware platform contains a mining element that automatically participates in the Bitcoin mining process, so it links up to that network. But rather than being a winner-take-all type of thing, where somebody who has a little tiny Bitcoin mining computer would never get anything in all likelihood, they use what's called buffered mining, where the rewards of mining are split among all the people participating in this 21 network. And so in that way, somebody who plugs in this 21 computer and then develops services has a constant stream of Bitcoins that are being deposited in their account as these mining proceeds. And those Bitcoins can then be used to engage in microtransactions and so on. So it's a way of kind of priming consumer networks and priming content networks to take advantage of this technology and to really build up a marketplace that individuals can participate in. And really to do that, they had to kind of come up with this alt-chain network to allow this buffered mining approach. So it's really very exciting.
Do you know how far along that that business model is? I think you said it's launched. Do you have any further information on how it's doing, how many people are participating, whether it's becoming popular?
The Liquid Network right now is in use in among a number of the larger financial services firms that are involved in the Bitcoin network. And my understanding is that the 21 network at present, you know, has a large number of users and has been gaining lots of functionality as they've been putting out all kinds of code and all kinds of updates that allow people to build in a very straightforward fashion their own online stores and to offer digital services available, as well as to, you know, and to buy and trade and selling these things. So it's really something that is rapidly developing and that's growing quite quickly.
Interesting. It's an interesting trajectory you described there. I want to encourage the audience to join the conversation. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. We've got quite a few people on the line and still some time left. Let me ask you, either of you, about sort of the Bitcoin chain. Why not replace Bitcoin altogether with another cryptocurrency rather than sort of tinker around with alt chains and this sort of what I perceive to be sort of modifications?
Well, Dean, that's a great. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Andrew. No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, you know, it really is a great question. And for what it's worth, since Bitcoin was invented, Bitcoin was the first one of these distributed cryptocurrencies. But since it was invented, a lot of people have come up with alternatives, some of which do innovate over Bitcoin in a variety of different ways. But Bitcoin has this enormous first mover advantage. People hold lots of Bitcoin. It's become recognized in a lot of parts of the internet as a viable means of interchange. In some parts of the world, it's become a viable currency. If you're in Venezuela and the currency is increasingly worthless, the legal tender is increasingly worthless, it may make sense to engage in transactions in Bitcoin because at least you know that whatever volatility there is in the Bitcoin market, the Bitcoin that you hold today is probably going to be worth more, you know, it's probably going to be a better store of value and more consistent in terms of how you can transact in it than the Venezuelan bolivars that you might otherwise hold. And so there have been all these attempts to adopt other types of virtual currencies with different types of designs that may offer some advantages over Bitcoin. But the problem is, where do you get the uptake? Bitcoin is where all the attention is. It's where people have focused their efforts. It's where consumers have actually bought into a certain extent. And it's where a lot of businesses have decided they're going to start taking this currency for transactions. And so when you think about something like alternative blockchains, the advantage is that you get to undertake the kind of innovation that you would with a new cryptocurrency, but you get to take advantage of all of the people already using Bitcoin. You get to take advantage of all of the software and tooling that are already applicable to the Bitcoin infrastructure and ecosystem. Basically, you get to take all of the mindshare and all of the advantages that come along with Bitcoin while replacing the potential detriments that may be there in terms of the technology, the underlying technology being slow to evolve. So it's kind of the best of all worlds to evolve this Bitcoin platform rather than to branch off and just start something new entirely where you really just start with zero.
Can we just add to this, in addition to all the sort of first mover benefits in the existing infrastructure that Andrew described, is sort of one other important factor. If the Bitcoin got completely vitiated, it would certainly be symbolically an unfortunate development because it would show vulnerability of cryptocurrencies to, let's say, a fairly precipitous and the associated ecosystem to a precipitous demise. Now, that of course happens quite a bit in the world of physical currencies, but physical currencies, ladies and men, have been around with us for thousands of years, so they're a little bit more resilient as far as the impact of these types of developments and their legitimacy, credibility. That's not the case with cryptocurrencies that are, again, historically speaking, quite recent additions. So not only it would be a pity to lose those benefits that I described, but it would not be good, frankly, for all cryptocurrencies.
Interesting. So the the alternative cryptocurrencies, the non-Bitcoin cryptocurrencies, they're not meant to overtake Bitcoin. They're sort of an addition to Bitcoin, it sounds like, rather than than trying to displace or disrupt Bitcoin.
That is correct.
Well, I think it's worked out that way, just because it's hard to get somebody to buy into one of these things. You have to have a network effect. If nobody takes your cryptocurrency, it's never going to be worth anything because you can't really use it for interchange or as a store of value. And Bitcoin is really the first one, and at this point, basically the only one that's gotten widespread enough usage that it's a viable currency in many circumstances. And just none of the other ones have gotten enough uptake that they've gotten to that point.
Let me make another call for questions. This might be our final call for questions. If you have a question, now's the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Well, gentlemen, I don't see that question. Let me give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts you might have. Mr. Grossman.
Sure. Thanks, Gene. All of this stuff is very exciting, and the amount of innovation that's being undertaken in this area is really just thrilling to watch, because some of the use cases really just suggest themselves in terms of privacy, in terms of auditing. You can really just imagine very easily the kinds of financial transactions that can be facilitated by this alternative blockchain technology, taking advantage of the existing widespread usage of Bitcoin. The real risk and the fear is that our regulatory environment won't evolve at anywhere near the same rate and may well wind up hindering a lot of really exciting technologies coming online in the next year or two. And so that's why, as we lay out in our paper, we think it makes sense for regulators to familiarize themselves with this next wave of innovator technology and give a very long and hard thought about where exactly it makes sense to regulate and where it is that forbearance is probably the better course.
Final thought from David Rogan.
I certainly agree with that, and I think what we're trying to do here is provide demystify the field a little bit, but also provide some clarity as to why what both Andrew and I call regulatory forbearance is appropriate. It's not to say that at some point in time additional regulatory clarity may not be useful, but it certainly should not be done hastily. It should be done only in situations where some specific problems have arisen that need to be addressed. Thank you, Dean.
Thank you both, gentlemen. I certainly appreciate your time. Andrew Grossman, David Rifkin, both of Baker & Hostetler. Again, the paper available on the Federalist Society website and linked to in the notice of this call. It's titled The Alt-Chain Revolution: Regulatory Considerations for the Next Wave of Bitcoin Innovation. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us. A reminder to the audience to check the schedule for our next scheduled Teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.